The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued.
Cassette 4, Side 2.
However, there was an unqualified renunciation of punishment blocks, that pitiless torture which could have been conceived only by the hate-filled minds of bourgeois prison keepers. The Corrective Labour Code of 1924 did allow, it is true, the isolation in a separate cell of especially troublesome prisoners, but it warned, this separate cell must in no wise resemble a punishment cell. It must be dry, well lit, and provided with the appurtenances for sleeping. At that point it must have seemed ridiculous not only to the prison keepers, but to the prisoners themselves, that for some reason or other there was no punishment cell, that it should have been banned. The Corrective Labour Code of 1933, which was in effect, that is, not in effect, until the beginning of the 60s, turned out to be even more humane. It forbade even isolation in a separate cell. But this was not because the times had become more complacent, but because other gradations of intra-camp punishment had by this time been mastered and adopted by following the path of experiment. In them it was not loneliness, but the collective that drove you mad, and on top of that, those who were being punished had to bend their backs. Strict regimen companies, RURs, which were subsequently replaced by strict regimen barracks, BURs, which were penalty work brigades, and strict regimen camp compounds, ZURs, penalty compounds. And sometime later, and somehow unnoticed, they added, not punishment cells, oh no, but penalty isolators, schizos. For if you didn't intimidate the prisoner, if there was no further punishment you could apply, how could he be compelled to submit to the regimen? And where could you put the captured fugitives? What was the schizo given for? For whatever they felt like. You didn't please your chief. You didn't say hello the way you should have. You didn't get up on time. You didn't go to bed on time. You were late for roll call. You took the wrong path. You were wrongly dressed. You smoked where it was forbidden. You kept extra things in your barracks. Take a day. 3, 5. You failed to fulfill the work norm. You were caught with a broad. Take 5, 7, or 10. And for work shirkers, there was even 15 days. And even though, according to the law... What law? 15 days was the maximum in penalty cells, though according to the Corrective Labour Code of 1933, even that was impermissible. This accordion could be stretched out to a whole year. In 1932, in Mitlag, this is something Averbach writes about, black on white, they used to give 1 year of schizo for self-mutilation, and if one bears in mind that they used to refuse treatment in such cases, then this meant they used to put a sick, wounded person in a punishment cell to rot for a whole year. What was required of a schizo? It had to be A, cold, B, damp, C, dark, D, for starvation. Therefore, there was no heat, lipi, not even when the temperature outside was 22 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit. They did not replace missing glass panes in the winter. They allowed the walls to get damp, or else they put the penalty block cellar in moist ground. The windows were microscopic, or else there were none at all, more usual. They fed a Stalin ration of 10.5 ounces a day, and issued a hot meal consisting of thin gruel only on the 3rd, 6th, and 9th days of your imprisonment there. But at Vorkuta Vom they gave only 7 ounces of bread, and a piece of raw fish in place of a hot dish on the 3rd day. This is the framework in which one has to imagine all the penalty cells. It is very naive to think that a penalty cell has of necessity to be like a cell, with a roof, door, and lock. Not at all. At Kuranach Sala, at a temperature of minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit, the punishment cell was a sodden frame of logs. The free physician, Andreev, said, I, as a physician, declare it possible to put a prisoner in that kind of punishment cell. Let us leap the entire archipelago. At that same Vorkuta Vom in 1937, The punishment cell for work shirkers was a log frame without a roof. And in addition, there was a plain hole in the ground. Arnold Rappaport lived in a hole like that. To get shelter from the rain, they used to pull some kind of rag over themselves, like Diogenes in a barrel. Here is how they were fed. The jailer came out of the gatehouse hut with the bread rations and called to the men inside the log frame, "Come and get your rations." But no sooner did they stick their heads out of the log frame than the guard on the watchtower aimed his rifle. "Stop! I'll shoot!" And the jailer acted astonished. "What? You don't want your bread? Well, then I'll leave." And he simply hurled the bread and fish down into the pit in the rain-soaked clay. In the Mariinsk camp, as in many others, of course, there was snow on the walls of the punishment cell, and in such and such a punishment cell the prisoners were not allowed to keep their camp clothes on, but were forced to undress to their underwear. Every half hour the jailer would let down the food shelf in the door and advise I.V. Shved, "Hey, you won't last, you'll die. You would do better to go out logging." And Shved decided he was right, that he would have the sheet pulled over his face more quickly if he stayed. He went out into the woods. Out of 12.5 years in the camps, Shved spent a total of 148 days in punishment cells. He had been punished for everything one could imagine. For refusing to be an orderly in India, the hoodlums' barracks, he got 6 months in a penalty camp. For refusing to allow himself to be transferred from a well-fed agricultural work party to logging, he was sentenced a second time for economic counter-revolution, 58-14, and got another 10 years. Any thief not wanting to go to a penalty camp could strike the convoy chief, knock his revolver out of his hands, and he would be sent nowhere. The peaceful political prisoner, however, had no way out. He would have his head forced down between his legs. In the Kolyma in 1938, the punishment cells for the thieves were heated, unlike those for the 58s. The BURs, the strict regimen barracks, were intended for longer imprisonments. Prisoners were kept there for a month or 3 months, for a half year or a year, or without any limit to their term, simply because they were considered dangerous. Once you got yourself on the blacklist, you would be pushed into the BUR the first opportunity. Every May Day and every November holiday, whenever there was an escape or any other unusual camp happening. The BUR could be the most ordinary kind of barracks, set apart and fenced off by barbed wire, with the prisoners in it being taken out daily to the hardest and most unpleasant work in the camp. It could also be a masonry prison inside the camp with a full prison system, with beatings of prisoners summoned one by one to the jailer's quarters. A favorite method that didn't leave marks was to beat with a felt boot with a brick inside it. With bolts, bars, locks, and peepholes on every door, with concrete floors to the cells, and an additional separate punishment cell for BUR inmates. This was exactly what the Ekibasuts BUR was like, although they had the first type there as well. The prisoners confined in it were kept in cells without sleeping shelves. They slept on the floor on padded jackets and pea jackets. A muzzle made of sheet iron completely covered the tiny little window below the ceiling. There were nail holes in it, but in the winter the snow covered even those, and it became totally dark in the cell. The electric light was not turned on during the day, which meant that day was darker than night. There was never any ventilation of the cell. For half a year, in 1950, the prisoners were not taken on even one fresh air walk. And so this BUR was very like a fierce prison, and it was hard to see what it had to do with a camp. The prisoners had to urinate inside their cell instead of being taken out to a toilet. The hauling out of the big latrine barrel was considered a privilege by the cell orderlies, because it meant a chance to gulp down some fresh air. And a bath was a holiday for everyone. The cell was tightly packed. There was room only to lie down, but not to stretch your legs. And this, for half a year. The gruel was water. There were 21 ounces of bread, and not a crumb of tobacco. If anyone got a parcel from home while he was in the BUR, anything in it which would spoil was written off. The administration grabbed it off, or else sold it cheap to the trustees. and the rest was put into the storage room to be kept for many, many months. Whenever such special regimen prisoners were taken out to work again, they would get a move on to avoid being locked up again. Sometimes, in this suffocation and immobility, the prisoners just couldn't stand it any longer, particularly those being assimilated to the thieves' law who were nervous and self-assertive. Thieves who got into ekibastuts were also considered 58s and had no special privileges. The most popular dodge of the BUR prisoners was to swallow the aluminum tablespoon provided for lunch. Everyone who did this was x-rayed, and only when it had been determined that he was not lying, that he really had a spoon inside him, did they put him in the hospital and cut open his stomach. Lyoshka Karnuki repeated this spoon-swallowing caper 3 times, and there was nothing left of his stomach. Kolko Salopayev played insane. He hanged himself one night, but the other lads there saw him, by agreement, tore down the noose, and he was taken to the hospital. Someone else contaminated a thread by putting it between his teeth and then inserted it with a needle under the skin on his leg. Infection. Hospital. He didn't care whether it was gangrene or not. Anything to get out of there. But the convenience of also getting some work out of the punished prisoners compelled the bosses to set them apart in individual penalty compounds, the ZURs. In the ZURs, in the first place, the food was worse. For months at a time, there might be no second course, and the bread ration was reduced. In the bath, even in winter, there was a broken window, and the women barbers in their padded cotton trousers and padded jackets used to crop the naked prisoners. There might be no mess hall, but they didn't hand out the gruel in the barracks either. You had to go to the kitchen to get it and carry it to the barracks through the frost and eat it there cold. The prisoners died in droves, and the clinic was filled with the dying. The mere enumeration of penalty compounds will some day constitute an historical investigation of its own, the more so because it will not be easy to carry out. Everything is being erased. Here is the kind of work they assigned the penalty compounds. Harvesting hay 20 miles away from the camp compound, where the prisoners would be quartered in shacks made of hay, and had to scythe in swamps with their feet always in water. When they had friendly guards, they could gather berries while they were at work. Vigilant guards would shoot to kill, but they picked berries anyway. They so wanted to eat. Or laying up silage in the same swampy places, amid clouds of mosquitoes, and without any protection from them. Your face and neck were eaten up, covered with scabs, and your eyelids were swollen. A man almost went blind. Or they might be sent to dig peat in the basin of the Vijegda River. In the winter, they had to open up the frozen strata of silt with a heavy sledgehammer and remove them, take the partly thawed peat from beneath them, and then haul it 1/2 mile uphill on sledges, doing the pulling themselves. The camp used to look after its horses. Or they might be sent to work at ordinary earth-moving, in the earth-moving camp, Nevokuta, for instance. And then, too, there was the favourite penalty work, the lime quarry and the calcining of lime. And the stone quarries. There's no room to list everything. All the heaviest of the heavy jobs, all the most unbearable of the unbearable jobs, that was penalty labour. And every camp had its own. The favoured candidates for the penalty compounds were religious believers, stubborn prisoners, and thieves. Yes, thieves. Here the great system of indoctrination broke down because of the inconsistency of the local instructors. They kept whole barracks of nuns there who had refused to work for the devil. At the penalty camp for prisoners under convoy at the Pechora State Farm, they held them in a penalty block up to their knees in water. In the autumn of 1941, they gave them all 5814, economic counter-revolution, and shot them. They sent the priest, Father Viktor Shipovalnikov, there on charges of conducting religious propaganda. He had celebrated Vespers for 5 nurses on Easter Eve. They sent impudent engineers and other brazen intellectuals there. They sent fugitives who had been caught. And also, with sad hearts, they sent socially friendly elements who simply refused to assimilate the proletarian ideology. Because of the complex mental task of classification, we will not reproach the administration for its sometimes unwitting confusion. From Carabas, for example, they sent 2 cartloads of religious women to the children's colony to look after the camp children there, and at the same time sent some women thieves and syphilitics to the Dolinka penalty sector, Kornspy. But they got muddled over whose things to put on which cart, and the syphilitic women thieves were sent to look after the children, and the nuns to the penalty sector. They later realized what had happened, but left them where they were. And often prisoners were sent to penalty compounds for refusal to become informers. The majority died there, and naturally cannot speak about themselves. And the murderers from state security are even less likely to speak of them. The soil scientist Grigoriev was sent to a penalty zone for that, but he survived. Also, the editor of the Estonian agricultural magazine, Elmar Nugis. There were stories of women in this context, too. It is impossible to reach a sufficiently balanced judgment on these stories, because some intimate element always remains hidden from us. However, here is the story of Irena Nagel, as she told it herself. She worked as a typist for the administrative section of the Uchta State Farm, in other words, as a very comfortably established trustee. Heavy-set and imposing, she wore her hair in long braids wrapped around her head. And partly for convenience, she went around in wide, oriental-type trousers and a jacket cut like a ski jacket. Whoever knows camp life will understand what an enticement this was. A security officer, Junior Lieutenant Sidorenko, expressed a desire to get more intimately acquainted. And Nagel replied, "I would rather be kissed by the lowliest thief in camp. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. I can hear your baby crying in the next room." Repulsed by her outburst, the security officer suddenly changed his expression and said, "Surely you don't really think I like you. I merely wanted to put you to the test. So here's the way it is. You must collaborate with us." She refused and was sent to a penalty camp. Here are Nagel's impressions of the first night she spent there. In the women's barracks there were nuns and women thieves. Who else in all world history ever equated them? What kind of person do you have to be to mix them together? 5 girls were walking about wrapped in sheets, playing cards the day before the women thieves had gambled and lost the girls' clothes, and so had ordered them to take them off and turn them over. Suddenly a band of men thieves came in with a guitar, in underpants and felt hats. They sang their thieves' songs like some sort of serenade. All at once, some other men thieves ran in a rage, grabbed one of their own wenches, threw her on the floor, beat her with a bench, and trampled her. She screamed, but then couldn't scream any more and stopped. No one interfered, and everyone just sat there and acted as if they didn't notice what was going on. Later, the medical assistant came in. "Who beat you up?"
"I fell off the bunk," answered the beaten-up girl.
At cards that same evening, they also lost Nagel, but she was saved by the bitch Vaska the Crooked. He squealed to the chief, and the chief took Nagel to spend the night at the gatehouse. The penalty work parties, like Parma Niroblag in the depths of the Taiga, were also often regarded as penalty assignments both for enlisted men in the guards and for officers, and offenders were also sent there. Even more often, however, they substituted trusty guards. If there was no law and no justice in the ordinary camps, then all the more don't look for them in the penalty camps. The thieves played their dirty tricks just as they pleased and went around openly with knives. The Vorkuta earth-moving camp in 1946. And the jailers hid from the thieves outside the camp compound, and this was at a time when the 58s still constituted a majority. At the penalty camp of Schwantwy, near Pechora, the thieves burned down 2 barracks out of mischief, stopped the cooking, drove away the cooks, and cut the throats of 2 officers. The remaining officers there, even under threat of being demoted to the ranks, refused to enter the camp compound. In cases like this, the chiefs saved themselves by resorting to the maxim, divide and conquer. They appointed as commandant of Zhuantui a bitch urgently brought in with his assistants from somewhere else. The very first night, he and his gang knifed 3 thieves, and things began to quiet down a little. It takes a thief to catch a thief, as the proverb had long since foreseen. The fathers of the archipelago, having, in accordance with the progressive doctrine, multiplied these socially friendly elements beyond all rhyme and reason, to the point where they themselves were being choked, could find no other way out of the situation than to split them up and sick them on each other in knife battles. The war between the thieves and the bitches which shook the archipelago in the post-war years. Of course, despite all their apparent bravado, the thieves themselves also had a hard time in penalty situations. This kind of debauchery was their way of trying to break out somehow. As with all parasites, it was more advantageous for them to live among those they could suck on. Sometimes the thieves cut off their fingers so as not to have to go on penalty work, as, for example, at the celebrated Vorkuta lime factory. Certain recidivists in the post-war period actually had inscribed in their sentence to be confined at the Vorkuta lime factory. The screws were being turned from on high. There, everyone went around with knives. The bitches and the thieves cut each other up every day. The cook, a bitch, served as he pleased. Some got it thick, some got it thin, and some merely got a whack on the head with the ladle. The worker signer went about with an iron reinforcing rod and killed men on the spot with one single whistling blow. The bitches kept young boys for pederasty. There were three barracks, the barracks of the bitches, the barracks of the thieves, and the barracks of the suckers, 100 in each. The suckers worked. Down below, near the camp, was a limestone quarry where lime was extracted. Then it was carried in hand barrows up a cliff, where it was poured into cones, leaving flues on the inside. The lime was roasted. They then had to spread out the burning lime amid smoke, soot, and lime powder. In the Jida camps, the penalty sector of Bayangol was famous. To Revuchi, the penalty camp of Kraslag, even before it had any penalty prisoners, they had sent a working nucleus of 150 strong sloggers who had not committed any infractions. It's all very well to talk about penalty labour, but the chiefs have to fulfil their plan regardless. So they simply condemned ordinary sloggers to the penalty camp. They even sent thieves and also long-termers under Section 58, heavyweights. And the thieves were scared of these heavyweights too, because they had 25-year sentences, and in the post-war situation they could kill a thief without having their prison term extended, and it was no longer considered, as at the canals, a sally of the class enemy. The working day at Revuchi was supposed to be 11 hours, but in fact, what with marching for 3 or 4 miles to the forest and back, it turned out to be 15 hours altogether. Revale was at 4:30 a.m., and they got back to the camp compound toward 8 p.m. The Zeks quickly began to become last leggers, and as a result, there were work shirkers. Following the general line-up in the morning, they lined these malingerers up in the club, and the worker signer went down the line and picked out some for a workover. These malingerers in rope sandals, shod for the season, 76 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit, and thin pea jackets were pushed outside the compound, and 5 police dogs were set on them there with orders to get 'em. The dogs tore them, clawed them, and knocked them down. The dogs were then called off, and a Chinese came up on a young bull harnessed to a honey wagon, loaded the malingerers into it, carried them off, and dumped the cart from the roadbed into a hollow below. Down there waiting was the Brigadier Lyosha Sloboda, who beat the malingerers with a club until they got up and began to work for him. He credited their output to his own brigade, while they got only 10.5 ounces each, a penalty block ration. Whoever thought up that whole graduated system was a real little Stalin. Galina Yosifovna Serebryakova, why don't you write about that? Why is it that your heroes sitting there in camp do nothing, work nowhere, and only talk about Lenin and Stalin? It was virtually impossible for an ordinary slogger from the 58s to survive in such a penalty camp. At the penalty work sub-party of Sevgel Dorlag, Chief Colonel Klyuchin, there was cannibalism in 1946 to 1947. People were cut up into meat, cooked, and eaten. This was on the heels of our people's earth-shaking historic victory. Ah, Colonel Klyuchkin, where did you build yourself your retirement villa? Chapter 16. The Socially Friendly. Let my feeble pen, too, join in praise of this tribe. They have been hailed as pirates, as freebooters, as tramps, as escaped convicts. They have been lauded as noble brigands, from Robin Hood on down to operetta heroes. And we have been assured that they have sensitive hearts, that they plunder the rich and share with the poor. O exalted confreres of Karl Moor! O rebellious romantic Chelkash! O Benya Crick! O barefoot Odessa lads and Odessa troubadours! And indeed, has not all world literature glorified the thieves? It is not for us to reproach François Villon, but neither Hugo nor Balzac could avoid that path. And Pushkin, too, praised the thief principle in his gypsies. And what about Byron? But never have they been so widely glorified and with such unanimity and so consistently as in Soviet literature. For this there were lofty theoretical foundations. It wasn't only a matter of Gorky and Makarenko. Leonid Utyosov howled nasally from the variety stage, and his delighted fans howled back in response. And it was in speech heavily influenced by the thieves' jargon that the Baltic and Black Sea little brothers of Vishnevsky and Pogodin spoke. And it was precisely this thieves' jargon that gave most of the expressiveness to their humor. Who was there who was not breathless with sacred emotion in describing the thieves to us, their vivid, unreined nihilism at the beginning, and their dialectical reforging at the end, starting with Mayakovsky, and in his footsteps Shostakovich with his ballet The Young Lady and the Hooligan, and including Leonov, Selvinsky, Inber, and you could go on and on. The cult of the thieves proved to be infectious in an epoch in which literature was drying up for lack of positive heroes. Even a writer so far from the official party line as Viktor Nekrasov could find no better model to exemplify Russian heroism than the thief Master Sergeant Chumak in the trenches of Stalingrad. Even Tatiana Yesenina, Zhenya, the miracle of the 20th century, gave into that same kind of hypnosis and drew for us the innocent figure of Venka, Jack of Diamonds. Perhaps it was only Tendryakov, with his capacity for looking at the world with unprejudiced eye, who first expressed for us, without licking his chops, the essence of the thief, showing his spiritual loathsomeness in 3-7 Ace. Aldan Semyonov is supposed to have been in camp himself, but in his bas-relief on the cliff, he has invented absolute nonsense. He has a thief, Sasha Alexandrov, influenced by the communist Petrikov, whom all the bandits allegedly respect because he knew Lenin and helped destroy Kolchak, a totally fictitious motivation dating from Averbach's time, who is supposed to have assembled a work brigade from the last leggers without living off them. But they did live off them, as Aldan Semyonov knows very well. And this thief even made sure they were properly fed, and that this even won from the free employees at cards, as if he didn't really need those winnings for the money to buy enough tea for a trip. And what a stupid, mothballed anecdote for the 60s. Once, in 1946, on a summer evening in the minicamp at the Kaluga Gates in Moscow, a thief lay stomach down on the windowsill of the third floor, and in a loud voice began to sing one thieves' song after another. His songs carried easily over the gatehouse and barbed wire, and could be heard out on the sidewalks of Bolshaya Kaluga Street, at the trolley bus stop there, and also in the nearby section of Neskuchny Park. These songs glorified the easy life of murder, burglary, assault. And not only did none of the jailers, instructors, or guards on watch interfere with him, but it didn't even occur to anyone to shout at him. This propaganda of the thieves' views, it seemed, in no way contradicted the structure of our lives or threatened it. I sat there in the compound and thought, what would happen if at this moment I were to climb up to the third floor and from the same window, in as loud a voice, sang something about the fate of the Russian POW, such as, "Where are you? Where are you?" a song I had heard in counterintelligence headquarters at the front. What if I myself had composed something on the fate of the humiliated and trampled front-line soldier? What an uproar there would have been, how fast they would have come running. And right in all that hustle and bustle, they would have run up the fire ladder to get me, not waiting until I was surrounded. They would have gagged me, tied my hands, and pasted a second term on me. Yet the thief went right on singing, and the Free Muscovites listened, as if that were the most ordinary thing in the world. Now, historically, as they never tire of saying in our country, this didn't happen all at once. In old Russia there existed, just as there still exists in the West, an incorrect view of thieves as incorrigible permanent criminals, a nucleus of criminality. Because of this, the politicals were segregated from them on prisoner transports and in prisons. And also because of this, the administration, as P. Yakubovich testifies, broke their licentiousness and their supremacy in the prisoners' world by forbidding them to occupy positions in the artels, income-producing positions, and by decisively taking the side of the other hard labor prisoners. Sakhalin swallowed them up by the thousands and never let them go. In old Russia, there was just one single formula to be applied to the criminal recidivists. Make them bow their heads beneath the iron yoke of the law, Urusov. And so it was that up to 1914, the thieves did not play the boss, either in Russia as a whole or in Russian prisons. But the shackles fell, and freedom dawned. In the desertion of millions in 1917, and then in the Civil War, all human passions were largely unleashed, and those of the thieves most of all, and they no longer wished to bow their heads beneath the yoke. Moreover, they were informed that they didn't have to. It was found both useful and amusing that they were enemies of private property, and therefore a revolutionary force which had to be guided into the mainstream of the proletariat. Yes, and this would constitute no special difficulty. An unprecedented multitude of newcomers also grew up to join them, consisting of the orphans of the civil war and famine, homeless waifs, or bezprizonniki, and hoodlums. They warmed themselves at asphalt cauldrons during the new economic policy, and for their first lessons they learned to cut ladies' purses off their arms and lift suitcases through train windows with hooks. Reasoning on a social basis wasn't the environment to blame for everything. So let us re-educate these healthy, lumpen proletarians and introduce them into the system of conscious life. And the first communes came into existence for this purpose, and the first children's colonies, and the motion picture, The Road to Life. But what they didn't notice was that the bezprizonniki were not full-blown thieves, and the reforming of the bezprizonniki did not say anything. They had not yet had time to be totally spoiled. And now, when more than 40 years have gone by, one can look around and begin to have doubts. Who re-educated whom? Did the Czechists re-educate the thieves, or the thieves the Czechists? The Urka, the habitual thief, who adopted the Czechist faith, became a bitch, and his fellow thieves would cut his throat. The Czechist, who acquired the psychology of the thief, was an energetic interrogator of the 30s and 40s, or else a resolute camp chief. Such men were appreciated. They got the service promotions. And the psychology of the Urki was exceedingly simple and very easy to acquire. 1. I want to live and enjoy myself, and F blank the rest. 2. Whoever is the strongest is right. 3. If they aren't beating you, then don't lie down and ask for it. In other words, as long as they're beating up someone else, don't stick up for the ones being beaten. Wait your own turn. Beat up your submissive enemies one at a time. Somehow this is a very familiar law. It is what Hitler did. It is what Stalin did. How much Sheyanin has lisped into our ears about the unique code of the thieves, about the honor of their word. You read him, and they all turn into Don Quixotes and patriots. But just wait till you meet those ugly mugs in a cell or a black mariah. Come on now, stop lying, you mercenary pens. You who have observed the Russian thieves through a steamship rail or across an interrogator's desk, you who have never encountered the thieves when you were defenseless. The thieves, the Urki, are not Robin Hoods. When they want, they steal from last leggers. When they want, they are not squeamish about taking the last footcloths of a man freezing to death. Their great slogan is, you today, me tomorrow. But perhaps they really are patriots. Why don't they steal from the state? Why don't they plunder the special country villas? Why don't they stop the long black limousines? Is it because they expect to encounter the conqueror of Kolchak there? No, it is because those automobiles and dashas are well defended, and because stores and warehouses are shielded by the law. Because the realist Stalin understood long ago that all this was just a big buzz, this re-education of the Urki. And he redirected their energy, sicked them on the citizens of his own country. Here is what our laws were like for 30 years to 1947. For robbery of the state, embezzlement of state funds, a packing case from a warehouse, for three potatoes from a collective farm, 10 years. After 1947, it was as much as 20. But robbery of a free person. Suppose they cleaned out an apartment, carting off on a truck everything the family had acquired in a lifetime. If it was not accompanied by murder, then the sentence was up to 1 year, sometimes 6 months. The thieves flourished because they were encouraged. Through its laws, the Stalinist power said to the thieves clearly, do not steal from me, steal from private persons. You see, private property is a belch from the past, but personally assigned VIP property is the hope of the future. And the thieves understood. In their intrepid stories and songs, did they go to steal where it was difficult, dangerous, where they could lose their heads? No. Greedy cowards, they pushed their way in where they were encouraged to push their way in. They stripped the clothes from solitary passers-by and stole from unguarded apartments. The 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. Who does not remember that eternal threat hovering over the citizen? Don't go where it's dark. Don't come home late. Don't wear your watch. Don't carry money with you. Don't leave the apartment empty. Locks, shutters, dogs. And nowadays, those writers of satirical columns who weren't cleaned out at the time ridicule these loyal watchdogs. In the consistent struggle against the individuality of a man, first they deprived him of one friend, the horse, promising a tractor in its place, as if a horse were only draft power for a plough, and not instead your living friend in sorrow and happiness, a member of your family, part of your own heart. And soon afterward they began a persistent campaign against his second friend, the dog. Dogs had to be registered. They were hauled off to the skinners, and often special teams from the local Soviets simply shot dead every dog they came across. And there were no hygienic or miserly economic reasons for this. The basis was much more profound. After all, a dog doesn't listen to the radio, doesn't read the papers. He is a citizen who is, so to speak, beyond the control of the state, a physically strong one, moreover, but his strength goes not to the state, but to defend his master as an individual, without regard to any kind of decree that might be issued against him in the local Soviet, and any kind of warrant they might come to him with at night. In Bulgaria, in 1960, the citizens were told, and not as a joke either, to fatten up pigs instead of their dogs. Pigs don't have principles. They grow their meat for everyone who has a knife. However, the persecution of dogs never extended to those dogs who were useful to the state, the security and guard dogs. How many citizens who were robbed knew that the police didn't even bother to look for the criminals, didn't even set a case in motion, so as not to spoil their record of completed cases? Why should they sweat to catch a thief if he would be given only 6 months, and then be given 3 months off for good behaviour? And anyway, it wasn't certain that the bandits would even be tried when caught. After all, prosecutors lowered the crime rate, something demanded of them at every conference, by the curious method of simply quashing cases, especially if they foresaw that there would be many defendants. Like the prosecutor Golushko, Izvestia, February 27, 1964. Finally, sentences were bound to be reduced, and of course, for habitual criminals especially. Watch out there now, witness in the courtroom, They will all be back soon, and it'll be a knife in the back of anyone who gave testimony. Therefore, if you see someone crawling through a window or slitting a pocket, or your neighbor's suitcase being ripped open, shut your eyes, walk by, you didn't see anything. That's how the thieves have trained us, the thieves and our laws. In September 1955, the Literatur Neue Gazette, which delivers bold judgments on many matters, but not on literature, shed crocodile tears in a major article. At night, on a Moscow street, a man had been noisily battered to death beneath the windows of two families. It emerged later that both families, our Soviet families, were awake, looked out the window, but did not go to help. The wives did not allow their husbands to go. And one of the residents in the same house, maybe he too was wakened, but the article says nothing about that, a member of the party since 1916, a retired colonel, evidently languishing without anything to do, had taken on himself the duty of public accuser. He was going around to editorial offices and courts demanding that those two families be charged with abetting a murder. And the journalist thundered also, "This didn't come within the terms of the criminal code, but it was a disgrace, a disgrace." Yes, it was a disgrace, but for whom? As always in our prejudiced press, everything was said in this essay except the main thing, that, one, the Voroshilov amnesty of March the 27th, 1953, seeking to win popularity with the people, flooded the whole country with a wave of murderers, bandits, and thieves, who had, with great difficulty, been rounded up after the war. To pardon a thief is to kill a good man. Two, in the Criminal Code of 1926, there was a most stupid Article 139, on the limits of necessary self-defense, according to which you had the right to unsheath your knife only after the criminal's knife was hovering over you. And you could stab him only after he had stabbed you, and otherwise you would be the one put on trial. And there was no article in our legislation saying that the greater criminal was the one who attacked someone weaker than himself. This fear of exceeding the measure of necessary self-defense led to total spinelessness as a national characteristic. A hoodlum once began to beat up the Red Army man Alexander Zakharov outside a club. Zakharov took out a folding penknife and killed the hoodlum. And for this he got 10 years for plain murder. "And what was I supposed to do?" he asked, astonished. Prosecutor Artyshevsky replied, "You should have fled." So tell me, who creates hoodlums? Three, the state, in its criminal code, forbids citizens to have firearms or other weapons, but does not itself undertake to defend them. The state turns its citizens over to the power of the bandits, and then, through the press, dares to summon them through social resistance against these bandits. Resistance with what? With umbrellas? With rolling pins? First they multiplied the bandits, and then, in order to resist them, began to assemble people's vigilantes, Druzhina, which by acting outside the legislation sometimes turned into the very same thing. But then how could they have simply forced them to bow their heads beneath the yoke of the law from the very beginning? The one and only true teaching again blocked the path. So what would have happened if those wives had let their husbands go out, and if the husbands had run out with clubs? Either the bandits would have killed them too, which is more likely, or else they would have killed the bandits and gone to prison for exceeding the limits of necessary self-defense. The retired colonel, taking his dog out for its morning walk, could in both cases have relished the consequences. Any genuine initiative like that shown in the French film The Waterfront at Dawn, in which the workers went about catching thieves and punishing them themselves without the knowledge of the authorities, would in our country have been suppressed as illicit. Could one even imagine that way of thinking and that sort of film in our country? But that is not all. There is one more important feature of our public life which helps thieves and bandits prosper. Fear of publicity. This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.